I said I was going to come in for lunch. I came in for lunch. Now we have to talk about it. That's how the podcast works. That's how I promise I'm going to come in and eat your food. And then months go by. And then finally, I get my poop in a group to come in and...
You put on a fake mustache and
horn-rimmed glasses, like a secret shopper.
And you come in and you eat the food, and a week later you tell me that you were there.
Tell you that I came just in. Kidding. Yeah, exactly. Right. Actually, more what it's like is like I walk into the dining room and they're like, Ego, it's Ego, Anton Ego. And then I sit down at the table and then I glance around the restaurant like with reproach.
You know? Right. Yeah. You came in for lunch.
I came in for lunch. That was a Ratatouille reference, by the way, in case.
Oh, yeah.
I know you get the reference, Alan. I just didn't want to leave anyone else hanging accidentally. So I came in for lunch. You were kind enough to serve me a couple of extra courses, which was great. So I got to try quite a few things that are on your lunch menu, the lunch menu that you're producing with your garde manger class.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I sat down, and then the first thing that that was like brought out to me was, I can't say it, Alan.
You have to. That's the whole point.
All right. It was chicken liver mousse McDonald.
Yeah, chicken liver mousse McDonald. It's a thing now.
It's a thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that was really nice. It was a little bit of a riff.
Just so everyone knows, classically, chicken liver mousse McDonald is chicken liver mousse served in a glass jar with, classically, a crab apple gelée on top. This was a cherry gelée, and so I hope you appreciate, I hope you know that it was an homage more than a traditional interpretation. But and we also added, there was toasted hazelnuts on top of the gelée for yours, which is not part of classical.
It's not the classic McDonald's dish.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I appreciate the homage, and it was very nice. I still think it's a good idea. You get like the nice like acidity from the fruit, and you get the richness of the chicken liver mousse. I really enjoyed it. I think like the mousse is like a little bit different from how I normally do it. Like I normally try to make this mousse quite soft, and this mousse was a bit richer than what I normally would do. I normally incorporate like quite a bit of like whipped cream into the mousse to try and keep it fairly soft, but.
This one did not have whipped cream folded into it at all.
It was a bit tighter, yeah. But it was delicious. And, I mean, I almost teared up.
No. Oh, my.
Yeah. I mean, like, I don't know. I know it's not really my dish, but it's something that we talk about all the time. Yeah. You know, it's, like, not something that I invented. But it's fun to think about, like, the idea that, you know, that it's a dish that, maybe for some people in Edmonton, I popularized or something. And yeah, so.
Yeah, well, you introduced it to me.
Right.
You introduced the whole concept to me. And it's something that we can talk about this in more detail later. But like even the very idea of a fruit, like a gelatin set fruit component, I keep like coming back to, I know you didn't invent fruit gelées, but like.
Yeah, obviously.
But like I keep coming back to like, oh, like we're going to make a rillette terrine, and instead of the traditional fat cap, we're going to
what put are we going to cap fruit, it with? Yeah,
we're going to put fruit jelly on it. And then I had students just 2 weeks ago, they were making pâté en croûte, and instead of the aspic, like instead of flooding the pastry, the cooked pastry with aspic, they were like, well, can we just like make a fruit gelée and like, can we put apple gelée into the pâté en croûte? And I was like, yes, of course you can. I've never seen that before, but like, why wouldn't
you? That's great. Was that the pâté en croûte that you took a picture of and showed up on your Instagram? Is that?
Not that particular.
Oh, okay.
There is a, I did post a picture of a pâté en croûte recently. That was with a traditional aspic, but these are students. They had a pork pâté en croûte, and their aspic filling was an apple gelée.
Yeah, that's cool.
It's pretty obvious in hindsight, kind of. But I was like, I've actually never seen that before, but it makes total sense. So, this was like your chicken liver mousse idea with the gelée cap kind of has been like a touch point kind of, or touchstone, touch point. Like over and over again, I was like, oh yeah, well, why don't we do that in all these different ways? So
yeah, it's nice to know that that idea is still out there alive and kicking, and that other people are going to get to experience it. So yeah, that was nice. I wasn't expecting that. And actually I had told you which dishes I was considering ordering, and you recommended, I think the normally that chicken liver mousse comes with the charcuterie.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Platter. Yeah. And you thought it would be better for me to have the veg platter instead. And so I was kind of sad that I wasn't going to get to try the chicken liver mousse McDonald, but then you brought it out for me and I was like,
great.
Oh, that's so nice. And then I had the veg tasting. And I took pictures of everything, and they're not the best pictures, but, I will post them on the, podcast Instagram. And so, yeah, the veg tasting had cucumbers and sumac, baby cucumbers, obviously, of course.
Obvs.
And eggplant conserve or like confit kind of. And then some pickles, cucumber pickle and a beet pickle and some honshimeji mushroom pickle, beech mushrooms.
Yeah.
And then peeled and dried cherry tomatoes, like just dried to the extent that they're like kind of not like raisins, but like
starting still to get jammy.
They're still moist, but yeah, jammy. Exactly. And then a pesto. Is that like it was? Is it fair to describe it as a pesto?
We call it on the menu, I think it's pumpkin seed pesto in quotation marks, because it doesn't have nuts and stuff in it. But
right, yeah, and some crackers, so some gaufrette potatoes and some seed crackers. Everything on the plate was like super tasty, really flavor forward. I really like the sumac. I find sumac can tend to get lost for some reason, but the sumac was like really punchy on the cucumbers, and I really like that. I would say that the seed crackers were a little chewier than I expected, not quite as crispy as I was hoping for. Maybe because they were a little thicker than I normally would make them, but the gaufrettes were beautiful and delicate.
Awesome.
So that was nice. And then I had the smoked sable fish.
Yeah.
Which is sort of like, how would you describe it? It's kind of like lettuce wraps almost in a way.
Yeah. And it could be on a good day, it could be eaten that way. Like like the little hearts of the butterleaf lettuce are used as a base. And then there's a canal of smoked sable fish rillette. So like shredded smoked sable fish in creme fraiche and horseradish. Garnished with the same seed crackers that are on the veg tasting. Dill and some pickled beets. For some reason on this dish,
the seed crackers that I got on this dish were like a little bit crispier than the ones that I got with the veg tasting.
Oh,
I don't
know
why that is or what happened, but yeah.
They should have come out of the same insert, so I don't know
why. I assumed that they did, so yeah, I didn't really know how to explain it, but yeah. Or maybe just like, I don't know, maybe because I was eating them with the sable fish or something, it was just like different or something, I don't know. But yeah, like it's like the cutest little like baby gem butterleaf leaves, and then this quenelle of the smoked sable fish rillette, and then a little bit of a seed cracker on each piece topped with a nice sprig of dill and then some of the pickled beets, I'm assuming, right?
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
There's pickled red beets and some golden beet puree as well.
Oh, it's golden beet puree.
Yeah.
Dang. I should have paid better attention. I actually did take a picture of the menu too, but I only referenced it a couple of times when I actually thought I had a question. For some reason, I thought that the golden beet puree, which was delicious, but I thought it was like a kind of a set dressing with cold pressed canola oil in it.
It does have cold. It is literally like it's golden beets cooked with a little bit of vinegar and water.
Yeah.
But then it's pureed with cold pressed canola to kind of.
All right. Well, that makes sense then. Yeah.
For the flavor and to kind of reinforce the color and stuff.
The color. Yeah. Yeah. It was delicious. I really like that puree. And like, yeah, it had like this real kind of umami. And I guess that's probably, now that I think about it, coming from the beets. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I found maybe like I don't want to critique every dish and I don't want to spend like an
that's
hour
what we're
talking
doing,
about
yeah,
the menu
we?
Either. But yeah, that's kind of why I came in so we could talk about it. Right. I found the smoke flavor in the Riet like a little strong.
Oh really? Okay.
Is it so the like, and when I say a little strong, I mean, I guess like slightly overpowering because like sablefish can tend to be like really delicate and kind of the flavor of it is like the, when you have it like not smoked, part of the like flavor of it is this like really buttery kind of characteristic. And in this presentation, I kind of feel like you lose that a little bit. Partially also, I think that has to do with the fact that it's cold and not warm. Like when it's warm, it's like, so, you know, you feel the fat in it a lot more or something right. like that. And so that probably partially has to do with the fact that it's cold. And, you know, when it's cold, you also don't get those subtle flavors as much. Like, you know, cold dishes, you have to kind of strengthen the flavors a little bit to get them across because you're just things taste stronger when they're warm as opposed to when they're cold. Yeah. But yeah, I found like the flavor of the smoke overpowered the flavor of the fish a little bit. And I was wondering, like, are you guys using like that smoked sable fish that like you order in sides, or are you smoking it yourself?
We smoke it ourselves. It's,
okay.
We're bringing it in like it's, IQF fillets, that we, I mean, the cure, kind of like cure in quotation marks, like we basically take the fillets and season them almost as if we were going to pan fry them. So just like season both right. sides, but then leave them on a wire rack overnight, uncovered to dry out the surface. And then usually for something like this or for like smoked trout, like you would just hot smoke it until it's cooked. But to try and preserve right. the like inherent moisture and fattiness of it, we do actually, we cold smoke it. And then after it has sufficient, smoke flavor, like we just gently bake it like a, you know, in a 225 degree oven or something like that.
Gotcha.
Until it's just set. So the overall effect is that of hot smoking, but we're just trying to not overcook it basically. So it's like right. a cold yeah, smoke totally. And a gentle bake instead. But.
Yeah. I mean, that, well, like that's kind of nice then, because I mean, obviously it's your dish and you, there's nothing in it to fix if you don't think there is anything in it to fix, but it, that gives you the opportunity to potentially control the level of the smoke flavor and stuff like that, which mm-hmm. is nice.
Yeah.
The other suggestion, like the suggestion that I was going to make, because you can buy sides of smoked sable fish and they're usually pretty decent quality, but like they also, they are usually, I believe, hot smoked, but like to the extent that like they're just barely cooked, like the flesh right. is still like, I've used that fish before and cooked it and you can still get it to be like, you know, it's never like, or like at least where the fillets are like thick, it's not like dried out.
Mm-hmm.
But the like near the tail end and on the belly where the meat is thinner, it tends to be like really smoky.
Right.
And so when we were using that on dishes in restaurants where I used it, the tailpiece and parts of the belly, we would use as trim and then make stock and then use that in another part of the dish. But
oh, okay. Yeah.
Anyway, it's pretty awesome that you're smoking your own fish. It's pretty awesome that they get to do that.
Yeah. That's one of the, like one criteria, of the one core, like learning outcomes curricula. For the class is like, salting, curing, drying, smoking, charcuterie type stuff. So
perfect. That's great. And then I had the famous Scotch egg.
World famous. Yep.
World famous. The Nate famous Scotch egg. Oh, actually I have a like a really good picture of this sablefish. That's a pretty good picture. It's like a real close up. The Scotch egg. So everything was delicious. I would say, I don't know if they're all like this, but I would say that my egg was a little more done than I was expecting.
Yeah.
What do you think about that? Oh, yeah.
Well, I think it's funny. I specifically remember looking at the egg that was served to you because I think, okay, on the menu, I think we say it's a hard egg. I think we say it's like spicy fennel sausage, and I think it says hard egg.
I don't think it does. Do you want me to check?
Yeah, if you want.
I can check right now. Sorry. Let me
see.
The
funny thing is
I think I checked, actually. Oh, okay, yeah. Scotch egg. Spicy pork sausage, medium egg is what it says.
Medium egg, okay.
So.
It's, Shale.
I'm here, Alan. So I'm listening.
The initial, go on.
You and I are compatriots, and I'm here to support you in whatever it is that you have to say.
You know that traditionally a Scotch egg is a hard-boiled egg, but the best contemporary versions of it, it's usually a soft egg or at least a jammy yolked egg.
Yeah, like a jammy yolked egg.
And that was the initial dream. And then when I was doing the testing this past spring, it was like, so finicky, like to be able
really difficult,
and especially
to get it.
Like with the contemporary presentation expectation is that, like, you know, you're gonna the chef is going to cut the egg open and present the cut side to guest, and getting a soft cooked egg to cut and still have the yolk in place was more or less impossible. I mean, sorry, it's not impossible, but like for culinary students to do it reliably for the presentation.
In the forum that you're like, doing it in. Yeah.
I was like, we'll just do kind of like the gelled yolk. So like something like a medium cook egg. And we bring in these special, like small sized eggs because the portioning makes more sense, as an appetizer. And
for sure. Actually, I was like, when it came out, like, because usually a Scotch egg is like sort of like an unwieldy behemoth. Right.
Yeah,
like, it's kind of, you know, there's a lot to it.
Yeah.
And I was like, I was really pleasantly surprised by, like, I mean, it was like a hearty dish, but like, you know, it was a small, like reasonably sized Scotch egg. Like it didn't feel like oppressive.
So I had dialed in the cook time for these eggs at 7 minutes, and the one, just like having been able to, like, we've served this now for 2 or 3 months and seen the iterations and how the students like interpret the recipes and everything. One thing that was happening is that for some reason in first year culinary school, they always say like a hard boiled egg should not be boiled. Don't boil the egg because that's too violent a thing to do to an egg or whatever. And okay, so I was having these sometimes students would read the recipe, which is basically like boil the egg gently simmer the egg for 7 minutes, but they wouldn't have the water hot enough. And so the water is just like just steaming kind of. And then the egg would be too soft. And when they went to cut it for presentation, the yolk would run out. And so for this, the particular group of students who are preparing, like doing the mise en place for the menu that you ate, I was like, 7 minute eggs, make sure your water is simmering the whole time. Like if the water is not simmering, it doesn't count as part of the 7 minutes. And so I think that these eggs were vigorously boiled for 7 minutes. And so, yeah, the yolk was harder than it was meant to be. So, yes. Noted.
Fair enough. Yeah, I know it's extremely difficult to get that right. And especially when you're exactly trying to have someone else do it who may not be all that experienced with cooking eggs. Mm. I mean, eggs are like, I don't know. I make ajitama all the time at home. Well, not all the time, but every once in a while at home these days. And even I sometimes find it difficult to get the yolks how I want them. You know, it's tricky. Yeah, the other thing that could have happened, I suppose, is like, you know, like there's such a big difference between like 85 degrees Celsius and like 95 degrees Celsius when you're boiling eggs, like, or like 97 degrees Celsius where you would be at like a simmer, you know, like
right.
How that affects the texture of the egg is like huge. And so, you know, if like, and always like when you, you know, bring your, are they like bringing the pot to a simmer with the eggs in the pot, or are they adding them to a simmering pot?
Like the so-called hot start method. So the water comes to a boil and then you add the eggs.
Yeah. And then you add the eggs and then that takes the boil out. And then how long is it taking you to get back up to that boil, and for which period, for how much time are you spending in the zone where the eggs are cooking? You know, like it's, that's really tricky.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was delicious. It's like a really thin layer of sausage, and the outside was so crispy, like so crunchy.
That's gluten-free panko.
Is it really?
Yeah, that's a gluten-free dish. And I'm just kind of like, it's funny, the gluten-free panko, it looks so much coarser than the, it is a bit coarser than the regular panko, but we decided that we were going to, the deep fryer in our kitchen would be gluten-free, and so we're only using like cup for cup flour. I don't know if you know that, like the gluten-free flour product and gluten-free panko. And yeah, I actually really like it. Like it has a really intense crunch.
It's so crunchy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Where do you get it from?
From Sysco.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Huh. Interesting.
Alan, what's so interesting about
fresh
panko?
I like, in grocery stores in Canada, you can basically only get like one kind of panko, and it's like, I think it's Kikkoman brand or something, and it's hard to get anything else. But
panko is not a brand?
No. Oh. Panko is a type of breadcrumb.
Oh, okay.
Actually, like, I don't know what. Panko is actually like two words. Pan is bread and ko means something else, but I don't know what it means. But
okay.
Panko is like, I think maybe ko is just crumb. I think it just is the Japanese word for breadcrumbs is panko. Yeah. So no, panko is not a brand. But the box that you see on grocery store shelves in Canada, I think is Kikkoman brand.
Okay.
Not positive. But it's like the only kind you can get, or maybe there's like one other kind that you can get if you go to an Asian grocery store or something like that. But both, like all of the kinds, I don't know, they're just like very run of the mill, I would say. And in Japan, they have access to like panko that has like huge shards. And they also often use fresh panko, which is like white bread or shokupan that has just been like shredded into like huge long fresh breadcrumbs, and then turns it like, so in a lot of places where you get tonkatsu, like pork cutlets, they have this like breading on them where there's like these pieces of like sharp like crunchy bread sticking off them, like it's really amazing. And it's just really hard to pull off here unless you make your own, and to make your own you basically have to bake your own bread, so I haven't really. But I've been super jealous. I've been watching a lot of YouTube videos of like people deep frying with fresh panko, and I'm just like, oh, why can't I do that?
But fresh, like it's fresh soft bread? Or you just mean like, okay.
Yeah, no, it's fresh soft bread. Huh. It's not even like dried out breadcrumbs.
Right.
I know, shocking, right?
Okay. Business. Yeah. There's, add that to the business opportunity list.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Panko is like a pretty crazy, you need kind of need a factory, I feel like. But maybe not so for the fresh panko. Like, I think for the fresh panko, a lot of places make their own just by shredding their own fresh bread. But anyways.
I like that Scotch egg dish. It's because it's like it's an overlay of a classic Scotch egg with like Italian sausage and peppers. Like, it's like a spicy, fennelly Italian sausage with... And there's like a little bitter green salad and some, and pepperonata. So like a charred pepper salsa kind of thing. It's my favorite one on the menu for sure.
It's so good. It didn't even, like, I was surprised that the yolk was harder than I expected, but it did not hinder my enjoyment of it. It was so well seasoned. It was so flavorful. It was so crunchy, and the pepperonata works so well with it. And then there's like a stripe of like also pepper puree or something on the bottom of the plate.
Yeah, it's tomato coulis.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. And you had
one little bonus dish at the end, right?
I did.
Remember that?
Rabbit rillette.
Yeah, not on the menu, but it was a terrine that we had made for a buffet the week previous.
Oh, I see. I thought maybe it had come off the charcuterie tasting, but
we do kind of like, if there's the charcuterie plates, like there's always kind of three proteins that are always on it. And for this season, it's the chicken liver mousse, bison jerky, and Ukrainian kielbasa. But then sometimes if we have extra things, especially from the buffets, they might end up on the charcuterie plate too. Rabbit rillette was just from a buffet that we had done the week before.
Man, I haven't had rabbit in so long, and it was weird. I like forgot how it tasted. And then when I tasted it, I was like, oh yeah. Like, it really has its own set of characteristics. I mean, it being a rillette, you know, sort of made it feel a little like pork or something, but yeah, it really has its own flavor characteristics. Mm-hmm. And it really is different, and I really like it. One thing about this that I was like kind of shocked by is like the way it was cut. Like, the portion is like a triangle and it's laying flat on the plate, and the way it was cut is like perfectly smooth edges. Like, all of the triangular edges were perfectly smooth, and the cut face of the portion was like looks like perfectly smooth. And that like tricked my brain into thinking that the rillette was going to be like almost like not homogenous, like a rillette, but like a pâté or something, right? You know, like a pureed farce. And then when I like cut into it with my fork, it was, you know, like just like confit pieces, you know, like bound confit shreds of meat. And I was like, how did you cut it so sharply and make it so neat when the texture is like so rustic? Like,
right.
I was shocked. Can you explain that to me?
So I think it's the two things are like filling the terrine with the meat worm, and then we like press it fairly aggressively. So like it's like a 16 inch long terrine, but we put 3 kilos of weight on it so that like
to make it as dense as possible kind of.
Basically. And then to slice it as cold as possible, but then temper it before you serve it. I think that's all it is.
I was wondering if you sliced it frozen actually. Like, I was
Did it have a gelée cap or was it a fat cap? I can't even remember.
It had a fat cap. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
And I was wondering if it was rabbit fat or if you like used duck fat to like
feed the rabbit. The rabbit was cooked in duck fat.
Oh, okay. So yeah, that's kind of what I figured.
It would have been, I guess, technically a combination of duck and rabbit fat.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just slicing it like immediately out of the fridge, like after it's been compressed, and then tempering it. Yeah. Before you serve it. But.
Yeah, well, it looks great. And then there's like some sour cherries on the plate. It looks like they were preserved sour cherries.
Mm-hmm.
And a little bit of granny mustard, a little quenelle of granny mustard. Looks like a very, it's sort of like a mini version of a very traditional kind of charcuterie, like appetizer presentation or something.
Yeah, totally.
And there are like baby leaves of something on the plate, and I couldn't figure out what they were. What were the baby leaves on the plate?
I think they were red mustard. I think they were baby red mustard. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, yeah, they had a pretty strong flavor, but they were like very fresh and they were like really nice. Like there's four leaves on the plate and each of them was just like, I don't know. They're like seemed alive. Like they were
from the urban cultivator that there's like the herb growing operation in the service hallway at Ernest's. And yeah, they were from that.
Right on. Yeah. So this was a nice little finish. I really enjoyed it. And the other thing about the cut of it is that there's pistachios in it as well. And like the pistachios are like, it looks like they're planed with a laser. It's crazy.
Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah, definitely check out the Instagram to take a look at it. Cause I wonder if the pictures that I have kind of look like more like top down, but I didn't really take, oh, this one has a pretty good profile. It's not the best focus, like the focus is a little bit too far forward on the plate, but this is a pretty good one. Yeah, I'll post this picture on our Instagram. Anyway, thanks for lunch, Alan. Everything was great. Are you enjoying this? Are you enjoying the change of curriculum and the new menu and the new students?
Oh, I love it. Yeah, it's awesome.
Yeah, that's awesome.
I think like we had a conversation a few episodes ago that was just like food obsessions. And I think that this class specifically is going to send me down a couple new ones. Like right now,
oh, that's awesome.
Pâté en croûte. Like that's the current one, like trying to just make it every week and make it better each time. And it's something that I don't even remember making it in culinary school, but like, it seems so kind of archaic and challenging and everything, but we've started making them for our weekly buffets and it's really fun. Right. And
that's great. Like a pâté en croûte involves so many techniques and so many skills, and to get it right, like it's really tricky. Like mm-hmm. You can learn a lot from doing that, whether it seems outmoded or not, or whether it's back in vogue or not, or whatever. It really is like a showcase for a bunch of different techniques that are hard to get right. And if you can mm-hmm. get it right, it's impressive. I kind of feel like it's taboo to talk about our cold open while we're having a cold open, but this has to be the longest cold open we've ever had.
I mean,
am I right?
It's maybe not. It's gotta be up there. We've had some doozies though. I don't remember how they were all edited and everything, but
At the very least, I feel like this is our longest single topic cold. I feel right. like maybe we've had a longer one where we went on some crazy tangent and I just like left off talking about something else for half an hour. But I think like for a single topic, this has got to be our longest cold open of all time.
So you want to talk about pâté en croûte then? Or I'm just kidding. Okay. Hey, Shale, welcome to Food Court. I'm Alan Sudeby, and I'm here with you, Shale, my good friend. We're two chefs in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. We love food,
and we love to talk about it.
Some might say too much.
I actually do have a couple of pieces of follow-up. Just little things that when I was editing the episode about chain restaurants, that mm-hmm. a couple questions that we weren't sure of the answers to, and I just happened to look them up while I was editing. So,
okay.
We weren't sure if Boston Pizza had many restaurants outside of Canada. Turns out that they have lots of restaurants in the States. Plenty.
Is that right? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I didn't actually look up the numbers, but I think they probably have more in the States than they do in Canada.
Makes sense.
Yeah. And then also, I think I wasn't sure where Red Robin was started, and I thought maybe it was started in Canada, like in Vancouver or something. Mm-hmm. And I don't really know why I thought that, but it turns out it was started in Seattle. So maybe that's kind of why, like maybe it started in Seattle and then moved to Vancouver, because that tends to happen quite a bit. So anyway, yeah.
Red Robins. Shale, are you familiar with Rockin' Robins here in Edmonton?
Yeah, I am familiar with it. I think I've been there once, but it was a long time ago. Yeah.
This is like
a... You just want to laugh about Rockin' Robins.
Well, I don't want to laugh. I ate there today. I don't want to laugh about it.
Oh, you did? Oh, okay.
I had corned beef hash there today. It was great.
Oh, sweet. That's awesome.
But it's... Rockin' Robins is a diner in West Edmonton on Mayfield Road, I think. Or 170th or something. And it kind of like... It became a thing with me and my friend Anthony, who works at Nate with me. We were doing a WSET class at a hotel across the street from Rockin' Robins. And a couple of times we tried to go there for lunch on our lunch break, and we could never get in because there was like an hour long wait, and they like give you they give you the pay, like on the weekends, they have to give everybody pagers, and you know, it'll buzz when there's a booth for you. And so that like really, really piqued my interest. And I was like, well, I got to get into this place. And anyways, today we went with the kids and had brunch, and it was good. Sweet. It's like a retro diner, right? Like,
yeah. And they have like crazy milkshakes there. I think maybe you can get milkshakes with booze in them there too, or something. Am I crazy?
You can get get boozy milkshakes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely think I went there like a long time ago, but I don't really remember too much about the food.
Yeah. Anyways, sorry.
But yeah, it's like
neither here nor there.
A very retro style diner.
Yeah, lots of Marilyn Monroe and James Dean on the walls kind of place.
Cool. I went to Kind Highlands this morning because they had like a autumn market. There's like quite a bit of space in Kind Highlands, and things slow down a little bit when we enter the cooler season. And so there was just like some craft vendors in there, and it was awesome. I picked up some bagels, and there was like art prints, and somebody who makes like candles and scents, and somebody else who makes pottery. I think they're going to be doing them like, I don't know, maybe like one a month or something throughout the winter. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it was really good.
And it's right in the main shop at Kind?
Yeah, right in the Highlands Kind ice cream shop. Hmm.
Cool.
If people who listen to the show aren't subscribed to the Kind ice cream email newsletter, there's usually a lot of good info in there. And if we do have events and things like that, it always gets announced in the email newsletter. I think you can sign up for it on the website, kindicecream.ca. So like the first time I've ever plugged Kind ice cream on, like legitimately plugged it.
Yeah.
That's weird. I feel like I should plug it every show. Whoops. Right now, I guess, Alan, it would be traditional for me to ask you if we have a topic, but I'm not going to do
Spare us.
I'll spare everyone the ridiculousness of that traditionally unfunny joke. And I'll just tell you what our topic's going to be. So recently, like in the last week, I guess, it was announced that a restaurant in Edmonton called Biera is going to be closing down, which is unfortunate because it's a good restaurant. And I know a lot of good chefs who have worked there. It's been open for, gotta say, 7 years or something like that. Maybe
something like
even
that.
Longer.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like right across from the original Kind ice cream location in Ritchie. And
kindicecream.ca.
And yeah, it's closing after a pretty long tenure. The original chef there was Christine Sanford, who I think we both know. Have you worked with Christine at all, Alan?
No.
Okay.
Have you?
I think peripherally.
She did work at Jack's, but our time, I never worked at Jack's at the same time as her. But
I see. Yeah, no, I've never worked in a place, like we've never worked in the same restaurant at the same time. Although she did interview me for a job at Kalina, which I did not get, which is, I still think is kind of funny. But we worked on a couple of pop-ups together, and I think, like, you know, wound up working the same events quite a few times and stuff like that. So I definitely have like some interactions with her, like where we've actually like cooked together and stuff. Anyway, when Biera opened, she was the chef there. She left, I guess, a couple of years ago now. Maybe not even 2 years ago. Like maybe it was like a year and a half ago. I don't exactly know the exact timeline. And honestly, I don't really know the reason why Biera is now closing. I guess like didn't really give much of a reason for why they're closing on their post about the fact that they're closing. Yeah. I think, I don't know. I probably should have had that post up so that I could talk about it. But it, from my recollection, it just sort of says that, you know, like they need to change, I think, the concept a little bit or something like that, which, you know, I guess like suggests that maybe it wasn't profitable, or maybe it was just really difficult to keep it profitable or something like that. And so I just thought it was interesting, and you know, it's like being a part of the industry, I think like it's pretty rare to find someone who hasn't been impacted by like a restaurant closure, either, you know, by being there when it happens, or you know, a restaurant that you used to work at closes, and then, you know, like you want to go and like try and have a last dinner there or something like that. Right. It's definitely like a big section of the plot of the third season of The Bear was a restaurant closure. And so I just thought it would be interesting to talk a little bit about Biera, talk about, you know, the fact that it's closing, what that means, and then talk maybe a little bit about restaurants that we have worked at previously that closed and how that affected us, and, you know, and just in general, how we think like restaurant closures affect people who work in the industry and also people who are customers that frequent those restaurants and stuff like that. It seemed like a pretty interesting topic. And as it happens, while I was doing a little bit of organizing today, I found a menu from a restaurant that I used to work at that has since closed, called The Blue Pear. And I think even recently on an episode, you asked me if I had any menus from The Blue Pear. And I think I said that I thought I did. And I was trying to remember some dishes and stuff, and I couldn't quite remember. But I found an actual paper menu from The Blue Pear. So I just thought I'd like quickly run through the dishes and then kick it off. What do you think? Yeah.
Right now?
I'm going to do it. I'm going to go through all the dishes. So the Blue Pear has a sort of, I guess you'd call it like a set menu, was the format of the restaurant. And this is like the full menu. It's called the 5-course menu, A Blue Pear Tradition. And you select, there are choices for appetizer, then there's a soup, and then there's choices for entree and dessert, and what's the fifth course? I said it was 5 courses, and I just said there was 4 of them. So maybe there is a
surprise course.
Maybe there is a palate cleanser. Anyway, the appetizer selections are bruschetta trifle, layers of tomato, bread, mozzarella cheese with basil gelée, and balsamic reduction. Or ratatouille served with roasted squid and bouillabaisse sauce, tempura tentacles, tomato concasse, and sautéed zucchini. Baked petite potato crepes topped with onions, local double-smoked bacon, cork cheese, baby organic mixed greens, and verjus vinaigrette. or mini croissants stuffed with grilled marinated duck breast and julienne vegetable finished with Asian barbecue sauce and sunny side up quail egg. It's so funny. Actually, you know what? I think it's possible that this is not a menu that I ever cooked, but that it's a menu that like I got when I went and had a dinner there before I worked there.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I think is maybe what's happening here, because I don't remember cooking any of these things. And then I was missing something. There's a soup and a salad. I don't know how I couldn't see that. This doesn't actually say what the soup was, so I guess the soup probably changed more often than the menu. But I will say that, like, in one of the times when I went and dined at the Blue Pear before I ever worked there, we were served a soup that was pureed Savoy cabbage with double smoked bacon.
Right.
And it like
talked about, yeah.
Yeah. It changed my soup life forever. Like it was so, the flavors were so delicious. It was like so delicate. It was like probably the one thing that like made me like fall in love with cabbage. It's the first time that I had cabbage where I was just, my mind was blown at how delicious it was.
Right.
And then, you know, just because of the seasoning and because of how well, like how smooth the puree of the soup was, it was just like, you know, no detectable, like it was just like perfectly smooth and a beautiful, like silky texture.
Mm-hmm.
And then it had like nice big lardon of bacon in the bottom of the bowl. And I think the soup was also flavored with bacon fat. Man, it was so good.
Awesome.
So we'll just pretend that that was the soup on,
right, yeah.
on this menu. And then there's a salad. That's the course that I, for some reason, my eyes skipped over. It says Spanish ensaladilla rusa, diced mixed vegetables, smoked potato puree, tuna, green olive sauce, chopped parsley. Huh. I don't know. Actually, that's ringing some bells. Just one choice of salad. And then the entree is a choice of either milk-fed veal tenderloin over mushroom reduction with potato Napoleon, asparagus, and jus, Brazil nut-coated halibut fillet garnished with scallop ceviche and served with triple-cooked yam fries, green beans, and acai fruit sauce enriched with butter, boneless lamb loin, phyllo-wrapped braised lamb, accompanied by rapini, spiced apricot couscous, mint yogurt, and lamb pomegranate jus, Berkshire pork loin and braised pork ravioli over beluga lentils with bacon, beets, apples, and finished with mustard vinaigrette and pork jus. Some of these things do sound familiar to me, like that I may have actually cooked them.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, yeah, this is a menu that you could get. Oh, yeah. Yeah, this must have been a menu that I cooked, because this menu is from May 20th, 2009, which is during the period of time that I worked there. So,
okay.
I'm looking to see if there's pricing on this menu, because I would be fascinated. Yeah, I'm not seeing pricing. So must just be like posted somewhere in the restaurant and told to people when they come in. And then they're also, they don't list the desserts on this printed menu. So there was a separate dessert menu. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. I don't have a copy of that. But I can tell you that you could add an Atlantic lobster tail to one of your entrees for $20.
Okay.
Yeah, that's like ridiculously cheap. And you could get an ounce of foie gras for $15. So
mm-hmm.
I feel like no foie gras add-on would be anything less than $45 now.
Yeah. A supplemental charge.
Yeah.
Okay. So if we're trying to, that sounds like a delicious menu. I would love to eat that. And especially if I were paying $60 in 2009 currency instead of $100 in today's currency.
I imagine, like, it was probably more than 60, but probably, yeah, that's probably, like, I bet it was under 100.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I would.
Yeah.
So if we're talking about restaurant closures, and I think you're kind of like hinting at, like, you know, what is the legacy or the enduring memory of places like this? How do you, like, you worked there, and so obviously you carry a lot of the, like, as someone who worked there and someone who still works in industry, like, you're kind of the torchbearer, such as it is for the Blue Pear and like some of the stuff that happened there. And but like, what's the real, like, long-term influence of that restaurant specifically, and who does it? Yeah. So tell me about it.
Yeah. It's so weird thinking back on it. Because the things that I remember, you know, like, I would say, like, primarily the first thing that I remember is the people, you know, like, I remember some of the food. I remember some of the dishes that I learned how to cook there. I remember some of the products that we worked there that I had never really worked with, at, you know, very much before. And, you know, I remember learning how to use those products and, you know, feeling like I was being, you know, getting an education by being there. But, like, you know, as you kind of alluded to, like, the real thing that I remember is, like, the impact that all of the people that worked there at that time, you know, have going forward out into the rest of the Edmonton food scene, like, whether it's, you know, before or after the Blue Pear has closed, you know, like, the people that worked at the Blue Pear, who moved through the Blue Pear, you know, like, a lot of those same people that I met then still have a huge impact on the food scene in Edmonton. Mm-hmm. Like, when I worked at the Blue Pear, I worked with Ben Staley, who was a high school student at the time that we worked together at the Blue Pear. Mm-hmm. And Ben has owned several, been part owner and chef of several restaurants in Edmonton, and has, like, you know, been committed to trying to do something with fine dining in Edmonton in a culture that is, like, pretty tricky to do that in. Mm-hmm. You know, like, Darcy and Jesse, who owned that restaurant, you know, both had a big impact on my, you know, like, on me fairly early in my career. You know, just like, both in terms of the amount of stuff that I learned about food while I was working there, and then also just the amount of stuff that I learned from them about working with people, you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, working with people and getting along with people. And I think, like, when I started working there, I kind of thought I was a hotshot. Right. and it like, both, like, Darcy's, like, crazy, like, constant creativity just, like, really put that into perspective for me. Like, that there is just, like, so much more that you can do creatively, and like, and there are some people who are, like, so creatively driven that, like, it's hard to keep pace. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, like, Jesse was, like, amazing at running that restaurant. And, like, in terms of, like, my personal interactions with the staff, she put me in my place a few times in a way that I think really affected me in my career, like, going forward, and really, you know, you know, like, nobody's perfect, and I definitely didn't learn everything I needed to know about interacting with my coworkers and this and also staff that I was managing. Like, it took a long time to learn a lot of that stuff. It's hard to learn, but, you know, mm-hmm. she really, like, in a patient way, like, tried to get me to realize that acting in a negative way in the work environment is just, like, you know, not okay, and it affects everyone that you're working around. And that was something that I was doing when I was working there. And she, you know, like, took the time to like, sit me down and tell me that that's not going to be okay, you know, mm-hmm. going forward. Mm-hmm. And that really helped me out, you know. And when I think about, like, the time that I spent there, it like was before, like just before I went to Europe, basically. It was like I was in Edmonton saving money to go to Europe, and then I was able to go. And I think it really gave me the grounding that I needed when I went to NOMA and worked at Fiskebar to like go in a way that was like eager to learn and as humble as I could be, you know, in those circumstances. Like it really prepared me for that. So I don't know. It's like every restaurant that I've worked at, and some of them have closed and some of them haven't, have had like a similar kind of impact on me, you know? And right. Then knowing that they now just don't exist anymore is just, it's a little weird, you know? Like I can still talk to people. Like I'm still friends with people that I worked with at the Blue Pear. I'm friends with Kim Thiret, I think is how you pronounce her last name, who also kind of works at Nate, I think.
Yeah, that's right.
Is that right?
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
In wine instruction.
You know? Right, yeah. She's an incredible sommelier, and I worked with her at the Blue Pear, and, you know, we are still acquaintances. And I'm still really close friends with a friend of mine, Clayton, and we worked at the Blue Pear together. And then there are several people that I'm sort of like, you know, still in contact with on social media from when I worked there, and we don't really interact all that much. But you know, I still, you know, it's like a really working with people in a restaurant is like an incredible bonding experience. It can be intense and stressful, and you really are forced to get to know the people that you're working with and how they react to things, and you know.
Mm-hmm. So if the Blue Pear is obviously a personal example for you, we started talking about Biera, which we kind of know a lot of the people who have worked in the kitchen there. But really, we don't have any special inside information about that.
No,
about that operation.
In fact, I've never even been in the kitchen in Biera. So
me either. I
just have to imagine it when people tell me stories about it.
But can we start to talk about like, so even at like whatever, we're industry insiders, but like we're, as far as Biera is concerned, we're both outsiders. Can we start to talk about like, for me, like even though, especially now, independent restaurants in Edmonton, there's one closing every week. But when I saw the fairly abrupt announcement that Biera would be closing, it was a little bit more of a gut punch than some of the other ones that have happened recently. Because it, even if it's in, I don't remember the exact year it opened, but even if it's only been 7 or 8 years since it opened, it has been one of the most important independent restaurants in Edmonton, and one of the really only a handful that over this time period have like garnered national attention. It would basically be Biera, Range Road, and maybe some of the Daniel Costa, like Uccellino restaurants like that.
I want to start the sentence before you move on, but then I can't remember the name, and then I'm desperately trying to remember the name of the place before I start the sentence, and then this always happens. Linnea. Thank God.
Yeah, okay, so
Linnea also,
Cafe Linnea. And so
got that kind of recognition.
And so in the same, and the only reason I didn't include Cafe Linnea is like, I'm talking about over the last 10 years, places like Range Road and Biera would appear on lists of the 100 best restaurants in Canada. Edmonton had this amazing kind of flashpoint, circa 2018, I think, where we had three restaurants in Edmonton that were on the top 10 best new restaurants, according to En Route magazine. And it was Cafe Linnea, Bar Clementine, and Alder Room, right? Yeah, Alder Room.
I think so, yeah.
Alder Room is closed. Cafe Linnea is closed. Bar Clementine is still there. But yeah, to me, Biera and Range Road are two two that have stood out on national lists for almost 10 years.
And they've kind of been institutions. Like, they've started to feel like long-lasting institutions, you know?
And so, yeah, it was just probably a week ago, right, that they announced they were closing. And it was pretty shocking for me. And if I could start to talk about, like, what was important or what is important about Biera, like, the things that I noticed. I've only eaten there, I think, 3 or 4 times. It did seem like it was in a kind of measured way, it was boundary pushing for Edmonton.
Yeah.
And things that jumped out at me, like, because even if I only ate there a few times, like, every time I would have to write a seasonal menu, there was like a handful of restaurants where I would go and read their menu and see what they were doing. Biera was definitely one of them. Some things that it was doing that really caught my attention. First of all, from the get-go, it's a restaurant in a brew pub. Like, it's a restaurant at a brewery, and it completely defied everybody's expectations of what a brew pub restaurant in Edmonton would be. Like, we think, like, a brewery
you would
restaurant
think of,
should
like,
have
pub food.
Yeah, burgers and chicken wings and stuff like that. And it was not that at all. Like, even if it made nods to that, it was not that at all. It was much, much more inventive. I was actually really shocked at just the ingredients that they were using. Like, the produce that they were putting on menus for Edmonton was very novel to me. There were things like the one that comes to mind immediately, like, they would have hop shoots, which you can grow in Edmonton, but you would never see hop shoots in a farmer's market in Edmonton.
No,
but they had them on the menu, and it made perfect sense for, you know, a restaurant operating in a brewery to serve hop shoots. And I think, I don't have any inside intel, but like, a few years on now, I think they were using like this really wonderful distributor called Gallimax, that like is really like tightly tapped into, small organic farms especially in British Columbia, but distributing through BC and Alberta. There was stuff on their menu where it just, even someone like me who had been ordering for restaurants, like doing procurement for restaurants for years, I was like, I don't even know where they get this stuff. Like, it's not a special connection with a local farmer. It's something else.
Well, and I know that like you're right. It's like a lot of, research in finding distributors who will distribute products that are, you know, either like difficult to get, less available, or also of better quality than you can normally order from like a large restaurant supplier, or even from some of like the smaller local greenhouse suppliers and things like that. A lot of the produce from Gallimax and stuff like that is like a tier above like what you can normally get from having relationships with people that sell at the farmers markets in Edmonton and stuff like that. So,
Totally.
But they, you know, like, I also know that like they put a ton of effort into preserving things that they could only get by having relationships with foragers and things like that. You know, like, there was also a lot of product on their menu that was like, I don't know because I didn't work there, but like, from what I kind of understand from hearing stories, like, product that like, you know, they would get a small amount of and spend 6 months to a year preserving before they were able to put it on a menu, and then be able to put it on the menu for a couple of months and then run it out, you know?
And that is another thing that jumped out, even like from dining there, but also just from reading the menus. The stuff that they were doing in-house, and then because of like the connection with Roger Letourneau, like, there was a lot of fermented and preserved, like, really interesting fermented and preserved products that were kind of like the real like thrust of flavor, and the kind of central concepts of a lot of their dishes came from these ferments. in a way that I hadn't seen in Edmonton before. And I think that kind of speaks to, like, again, like, it was not an, it's not avant-garde the same way that even the Blue Pair was, but I do think that in, like, a kind of measured way, they really were pushing, like, flavor combinations and flavor intensities for Edmonton's scene. Like, I would just read their menus and be like, I've never seen that before. It sounds awesome. Like, it, and a lot of their dishes were really punched up in a way that even a place like, you know, Uccellino was one of my favorite restaurants in the world before it closed recently. But, like, there wasn't very much novel or, like, boundary pushing about the flavor combinations or the flavor intensities. It was just, like, excellent, well-executed food. But some of the something like one of the more recent staples on the menu at Biera was these fromage blanc dumplings. I can't remember if that's what they called them, but they were like basically like nudie or like these kind of like dumplings made from fromage blanc made by.
Yeah, I think I had them the last time I went. Yeah.
And like that, you know, that could be a dish at Uccellino or Corso, like if it were, you know, rebranded as gnocchi. But they were like served in a searingly acidic whey based broth, like really, really intense flavors and not like in an exciting way, not in a off-putting way. And I think like a lot of the dishes that I really remember from Biera are like that, where it's like, it's you know, it's a bitter, some kind of bitter green, like endive or frisée with citrus, but it's like the bitterness is like intense and the citrus is intense.
But it's working, like,
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's one of the things that I, kind of, to me, that's like one of the hallmarks of their menus and their style.
To me, like, I think for me, when I think of like, if I try to sort of like categorize in my head, like what I think, like a way of describing the food, you know, I think like, because oftentimes when I was going there, with my family and, you know, some of whom have had a ton of like, are like, you know, real foodie types and have had a lot of dining out experience and have had a lot of eating experiences that are, you know, like, maybe weirder than normal or something. Mm-hmm. And then some also like, some of my family who are just like, you know, much more used to eating like, you know, normal restaurant food and, you know, like, and a lot of the things on the menu would be unfamiliar to them. Mm-hmm. Right. And, but like, I feel like in most cases, like a lot of the time, maybe since some of the food was in the way that it was described on the menu was unfamiliar to some of the people that I was dining with, like I would sometimes be given the job of sort of like ordering for the table. But once we were like ordering and the food came, if it like seemed a little like out there on the menu, when they read the menu, once we were eating it, it was like, oh, like
it's delicious. Yeah.
This tastes amazing. Or, you know, like, oh, like I've never had a piece of pork cooked like this, you know, or like, you know, just like really, I think that there can be a tendency, you know, for, restaurants that are pushing creativity in that way, you know, to lose a little bit of the like approachability of the flavor. But I feel like that just always, that was just like never a concern. And like, it, you know, I think in most cases, you know, people were excited to go back, that, you know, like I was always excited to go back, but like, I think, you know, like in a lot of cases, like, people that I wouldn't necessarily normally expect to be excited about that kind of food were excited to go back. Mm-hmm. And there were a couple staples on the menu too that were just like real bangers, and that, you know, that would, like the sourdough cubes. Is that what it was? I can't remember what it's called.
Well, I was going to say it showed up in a few different dishes and everything, but they're sourdough. Yeah. And especially I think it always had a, what's the word? It was like, it had a spent grain component. So there was like the right. spent malted grain from the brewery right. would be incorporated in the sourdough. You can order it on its own, usually with some kind of cultured butter, or it would be served with the tartare or whatever it was. But there,
Or they like had this dish that was like pretty regularly on the menu, I think, that was like basically sourdough croutons. And they were warm, and then they were tossed in like a soft cheese and like,
right. Yeah.
Amazing.
And that, okay, I've got lots I want to touch on, but another thing, like, one thing they did really well was even though they had the kind of, the new wave, the ferments and the interesting flavor combinations, they still like were really into old world things like cheese. They have, mm-hmm. especially now, this is another closure that actually shocked me this past year, Shale. Patty's International Cheese Market. I don't know if you know that it closed this past spring. Did you know that?
No, I didn't know that.
And that is, as far as I'm concerned, the
last... I
thought
they were like moving or something, but...
No, they're closed.
Patty's is closed? Oh, yeah. No.
And that is really, like, I know we still have the Italian Center and stuff, but that was the last, dedicated cheesemonger, like, a store entirely devoted to curating cheese. It's gone now, and there's not anything like that in Edmonton anymore. But anyways, Biera had the best cheese list in Edmonton for a restaurant, and took cheese and cheese service very seriously. Like it's probably the only place you could walk into any day and get like Munster or Epoisses and like these really like funky washed rind cheeses. And some of their menu items hearken to those old, like those European preparations. Like one of their famous dishes was like a Flammenkuchen, so like a fresh cheese and bacon pie, basically like a pizza kind of. I'll also say that they did like wood-fired grilling the best and most consistently. Like it was kind of like that became a kind of vogue thing. And there were a handful of restaurants in Edmonton that were, making that a centerpiece, to their cooking, like Woodwork and, Smoky Bear and places like that. For my money, Biera did it by far the most consistently, and at the highest level. There like some of those other kitchens like had a little bit of, maybe like some tumultuous turnover and could never really deliver that high quality wood fired product as consistently as Biera. So
what do you think happened, Alan?
Oh God, I have no idea. I'm not going to touch that. I don't know. How would I know?
Yeah. And I don't know either, but I guess like what, that's maybe not the right question, but I guess like, why does it happen? Like why is the business so tough? You know, why is there always something that's closing? Why is there always like a staple institution dining experience that is just no longer available?
Well, I don't think you have to be too philosophical about it. Like we know that the cost of goods has risen by 50-75% in the last 2 years. Like that should be reason enough. Like for whether it's fine dining or casual, we know the margins are so narrow in food service that something like that would sink half of the businesses that operate anyways. Do you know what I mean? So like we can speculate about other stuff, but
I don't want to try and like speculate about why. Like, I have no information, and I know that you don't either. I just like, man, you know, like hearing that a place like Patty's is just gone, right? And then like a place like Biera is just like it's not going to be there anymore. Like it, I don't know. It's not like my intention to, like, you know, make this conversation, like, you know, a downer. I think that, like, you know, there's, like, also, well, like, for instance, if the Blue Pair had never closed, Range Road would likely not exist in the form that it's in, because it's in the space that the Blue Pair used to be in.
Right.
You know, and like, I do think that there is a sort of, like, a circle of life like that, or something, mm-hmm. where, you know, all of the people that went through Biera are now going to be involved in other parts of the food industry in Edmonton. I know Christine is, like, working on some things with Roger. And, you know, right now I have a cook named Thomas who was one of the chefs who helped open Biera and was there for, like, 2.5 years, is now working with me at Kind, you know, and like, these things continue to weave themselves through, like, you know, the community, the food community in Edmonton. Mm-hmm. And you don't really necessarily lose, like, the education that people get and the experience that people gain. And sometimes you also don't necessarily lose the location. You know, like, once a place is a restaurant, it often winds up being a restaurant again after that, because it's just, like, you know, so expensive to build out a restaurant from scratch that most of the time when people are opening a restaurant, often they're looking for places that previously were restaurants that have, like, some of the infrastructure in place.
Right.
I don't know what I'm trying to say, but it's, like, kind of bittersweet. I think that something like Biera, I sort of feel like something that's that good kind of has an inherently short shelf life or something, you know? Mm-hmm. Like,
okay.
It's difficult, you know, like, it's like, requires the passion of a lot of people to make a restaurant as special as Biera was, or as Uccellino was, or as the Blue Pear was. And I feel like it's a finite resource, you know, like, even for people who still have that passion, but then, you know, like, have to move on from that project. It's like, I don't know, like, when I think of, like, you know, when I think of, like, restaurants that have been open in Edmonton, like, for decades, I would say most of them are not that exciting to me. I can name a few, like, I can name a few exceptions. Bistro Praha is, like, one big exception, I think. Mm-hmm. Like, that place mm-hmm. has been open, I don't know, maybe as long as I've been alive. I'm not really sure. It burnt to the ground and had to move, and it's still going. So, you know, there definitely are some exceptions, but, like, you know, like, most of the places that have been open for as long as a place like Bistro Praha are either chains, or they're just, like, like, just restaurants that I'm just not really interested in eating at. And I don't really, I guess, like, okay, here's an interesting one. I'm curious to know what you have to say about this, but have you ever eaten at Normand's?
No, never.
Okay. Yeah. Neither have I. Okay. And I have, like, a pretty good friend who, like, he's no longer a cook, but he worked there for, like, I think a year or maybe a little bit longer, when we were, like, fairly young. I think when he was in, like, his early 20s or something. Mm-hmm. That restaurant is definitely an institution. But I don't know. Like, there's nothing compelling me to go there. I feel like I kind of know I'm going to get old school food and that it won't be anything that will be surprising to me. I don't know. Right. Maybe that's giving it short shrift, but I feel like the kinds of restaurants that people get super excited about, that the both like the excitement on the part of the diners and the passion on the part of the people that are making that restaurant exciting is like a limited resource, and that you sort of have to take that into account, that, you know, like, I don't know. What do you think about that?
Well, I feel like in a weird way, the type of restaurant that you're talking about, like, is a much narrower and more specific kind. Like the, like, for instance, Shale Noodle Feast, Izakaya Tomo,
yeah,
Tao Bay, King Noodle,
right?
Like, these are restaurants that have been around for decades that are still awesome, and I'm still very
excited
to eat.
Has Noodle Feast been around for decades?
I don't know.
I feel like
I have
it
no
was
idea.
Pretty new. Okay, but Tomo and Tomo has been around for decade, at least, like more than
okay,
a decade.
Sorry, do you understand the point I'm trying to make, though? Like,
I think
we're I think there's this really odd, and this kind of harkens to our Jonathan Gold conversations, maybe, but like this odd, like, scenester vibe where it's like, yeah, right. Like the restaurants that are written about in Edify and Avenue, the Tomato, like, that's what the food scene is, but that's not really what the food scene is. The food scene is like, there's dozens or hundreds of like much lower key places that are still exciting to eat at. And
4, 5, 6.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
So I don't really like it. It feels a little bit different now than it did, say, like in 2017 or 2018 when Edmonton had those three restaurants on the en route top 10 new restaurants. But like, there's still lots of really great, small, independently owned, delicious, exciting restaurants here. And I've eaten at some of them this week, Shale. Like Thai Avenue. Awesome.
Oh, sweet.
Do we have this conversation already? Like,
we did talk about Thai Avenue. Yeah.
So I don't know. Biera closing what did feel like a gut punch. But I don't think we're in the end times. I don't think.
Yeah, I don't know. No, yeah. I definitely wasn't trying to say that we're in the end times. I think I was trying to say that, like, I think that there are, yeah, maybe what I was trying to say is a little bit like the flame that burns twice as bright only lasts half as long or something, you know? Like,
oh, that sounds nice.
Something, you know, like something along those lines where, like, you know, when I'm talking about Biera, I'm talking about something that really, like, I think something like Tomo has great food and it's a fun experience to go to, but it's not like, it doesn't require the same level of like passion and commitment that something like Biera does, you know, like you were saying, you know, like sourcing product that no one else can source and, you know, putting so much time into product that, you know, like making product that most people would see as inedible into something amazing, like that kind of like extra above and beyond passion and commitment. I feel like that's where that, you know, like I, like you're right. There is a ton of great food in Edmonton, but like the things that really, you know, the very top of the Mutar Conservatory pyramid, like the very, you know, like the the very tip of the most excellent dining experiences here or anywhere else require a level of passion and commitment that is like higher, I think, than something like Tomo that is like gonna, you know, be there providing a consistent experience for people, but one that's maybe just like, you know, fun and enjoyable but not necessarily eye-opening or something like that. You know, and I think like in instances where restaurants require that like additional level of passion and commitment, it's tough, I think, to make that sustainable because, right. you know, with every restaurant, you're going to have, you know, you're going to lose employees who are vital, you know, who have like vital knowledge, or, you know, you're going to, the team at some points is going to be changed, is going to change. And sometimes it'll be, sometimes it can get stronger and sometimes it can get weaker and sometimes it can be weaker for a little while. And that makes it harder, you know, and like, you know, there are just a lot of things that can change and, or, you know, the price of goods, like something that was sustainable maybe for like, you know, the previous 3 years becomes unsustainable. And then, and you know, because you're just like riding that like razor's edge of like, okay, we're just like, you know, we're putting everything we have into this and just making it work, you know? And I think restaurants that operate kind of on that ragged edge of sort of like what's possible for the people who are making it work, you know, it's, I think much more likely that, you know, they might run into a problem that makes it less tenable for them to keep going forward.
So then what's the lasting effect of the restaurants that are able to do that? Like, because I think that the people who were there in those kitchens can kind of take something with them, but a generation on, most of that will be lost, right? Like in terms of whether it's the practical knowledge or just the inspiration, right?
Yeah, like exactly. Like a restaurant that like I worked at, like the Blue Pear, if I don't have a paper menu in front of me, I can barely remember the dishes that we made. I remember like bits and pieces and flashes and things. And like, I'm sure it's going to be, you know, same for a lot of people who worked at Biera like a decade from now, like how many of the dishes and components are they actually going to remember, you know? Like I'm sure Christine will probably remember a lot of them because she invented a lot of them probably, but yeah, it just, you know, it's, I mean, I think the, I think like what's like, to answer your question, I think like what's left or what's the legacy of something like that has to just be in like the growth of the like if Biera was like pushing boundaries for the types of food that people in Edmonton were like exposed to, and also like it both on the side of like the people who were cooking it and the people who were dining there, you know, in 10 years, does that mean that there can be another restaurant that pushes things a little bit further? Are there, you know, is there someone who worked there who 5 years from now is going to open another restaurant that, you know, pushes even more boundaries, or, you know, is another training ground for, you know, people who want to learn things that they can't just learn at any chain restaurant, or, you know, I think the legacy has to be in the people. Yeah. And mostly I would say, you know, there are, I'm sure that like Biera has, you know, a set of like, regular diners who will really miss it, you know, people who went there a lot, more than I did. Like I probably went there less than once a year since it was open, maybe close to once a year, but maybe slightly less than that. Actually probably less than that because, you know, COVID and stuff. And I definitely wasn't eating food from Biera during COVID.
Right.
I think maybe I had one box lunch or something like that. But yeah, like there will be diners who will remember dishes and will miss it. But, you know, like what's the lasting effect of that? Yeah, that's hard to answer. But I think the lasting effect of like people who learned things working there, you know, that's the real contribution that hopefully it will make to the food scene in the city going forward. I don't know. It's still sad. Are you going to try and go there? It's open until the end of December, I believe.
It's funny. So. I actually I was invited to go there for dinner just a couple nights ago, and I just just couldn't make it work. But
oh, and you couldn't. Oh,
it would have been good for this recording if I had gone. Because
it would have been great for this recording. That would have been an amazing surprise if right now you were like, guess what, Chill? I just ate there 2 days ago.
Yeah. No, Anthony and Karen, who I thought Nate for a farewell dinner a couple of nights ago. But
Honestly, I didn't think that this conversation was going to become some maudlin.
What did you expect?
I don't know really why I thought that. You're right, Alan. I don't know why I didn't expect it to, you know, like make me sad. I think when I was thinking about it in my mind, and maybe I was just like making justifications or something, but I think the thing that I sort of had in the back of my head was that, you know, like most of the people that I know that work there have already moved on from Viera and are already doing other things and succeeding at them. And, you know, like, and so it did, you know, like it doesn't feel like, it doesn't feel like it's a shocking blow to like a really, you know, like if like the team that was currently working at Viera was like, you know, a bunch of people that have been working there basically since it opened, I think that it would feel a lot more heartbreaking to me. But I know that a lot of those people have already moved on and are doing other things and are happy in their careers. And, you know, and so I can see that, you know, like it sort of preemptively has already started down that path of like percolating out into the rest of the industry. And so, you know, like it doesn't feel like I'm going to miss it. And I do think it's unfortunate that it's closing, but I do think that like it's already having its effect. And, you know, like I think that like, I don't think there's not going to be a restaurant there. I don't think that whatever restaurant winds up being there will, you know, it will compare to Viera in any way, but it will, there will be something else and there will be something else in that space and it'll be something new to try and hopefully it'll be good and hopefully it'll last. And if it's not, then I'm sure something else will take its place too. Like, yeah, I'm like kind of encouraged on, you know, like what would be, I think, sadder is if like Viera didn't close and in 3 years it was still Viera, but it was just a pub.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like,
right. Yeah.
I think, you know, like if it can't be Viera, if it can't be like this, you know, have people who are like passionate about cheese making a cheese list and you can go in and get cheese that you can't get anywhere else in the city. And if it, you know, if it can't be like we're taking, you know, ingredients that nobody else is willing to touch and turning them into like a magical dish, if it can't be that, then it should bookend, you know? Mm-hmm. And if it's, and then it can like go and be something else without like turning, you know, like without trading on the capital that like the passion of the people that work there built to, you know, just turn into something that's mundane, you know?
Right.
And that to me, I think maybe is a little bit encouraging, you know, that the people that own it maybe understand that they don't want to do that. You know, they don't want to just like turn it into, they keep it the same, but turn it into something mundane, you know, like, so, okay, we're going to close this and then figure out what to do next. I think it's, yeah, I'm sure it was a very difficult decision to make and it seems like the right one if it's not going to be able to continue to be what it is, you know?
Right. And that's the other thing is that the, like, it's not just the restaurant that they're closing, it's the brewery as well. So Blind right. Enthusiasm is closing as well.
Right. But their other brewery is not, right?
Right. Monolith. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's that part of like when I'm thinking about that logistically, like that blows my mind. They have all this like giant brewery equipment in there. I wouldn't want to be in charge of figuring out how to, what to do with that or how to move it or fix it or get rid of it or do whatever they're going to do with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe we should buy it. Do you want to start a brewery, Alan?
Listeners, you can help support Food Court and access great bonus content by joining our Patreon at patreon.com/foodcourtpod. If subscriptions aren't your thing, you can leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Food Court is recorded in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Your hosts are Alan Sedeby and Shale McDonald. Theme music by Ryan McDonald. To get new episodes on the day they're released, follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast player. We love to hear from you all. Please drop us a line at feedback@foodcourt.fm or find us on Instagram @foodcourtpodcast. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a fresh new episode. Thanks for listening.